loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, President Trump said last night, perhaps in an unguarded moment, that he was willing to speak under oath with special counsel Robert Mueller. The president's attorneys quickly backtracked. Meanwhile, Mueller and his staff met last week with Attorney General Jeff Sessions, as the investigation seems to be turning more and more towards obstruction of justice and possible money laundering. Next, we begin a new weekly segment that we call Criminal Injustice. We look at some of the most egregious conduct of the courts and prosecutors and at how justice is so routinely denied to so many people in this country. In today's segment, judges in the state of Oklahoma are sending people arrested on minor drug charges to a program called Christian Alcoholics and Addicts in Recovery. But in reality, they're sent to work in dangerous chicken processing plants. Prisons in America are based, in fact, on slave labor. But first, we turn to the so-called Russiagate investigation. President Trump said last night, perhaps in an unguarded, unscripted moment, that he was willing to speak under oath with special counsel Robert Mueller. The president's attorney quickly backtracked, saying that he would be with him during the meeting. Meanwhile, Mueller and his staff met last week with Attorney General Jeff Sessions, as the investigation seems to be turning more and more towards a possible obstruction of justice and money laundering. Russia no longer seems to really be central in the mix. Well, we'll see about that. We've been joined from New York by three guests. Daniel Lazar is a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. We're also joined by Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. And Randy Credico, activist, comedian, and the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Welcome to the three of you.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hey, it's great to be back.
Let's start with you, Jim Kavanaugh. Donald Trump said he was be more than willing to meet with Mueller under oath. Then, of course, there were some caveats thrown in, and his lawyer, Ty Cobb, said, well, maybe it depends on what we decide. Anyway, do you think it's significant? And then we're going to talk about some other new developments in this case.
Well, anybody who listens to what Donald Trump says right now should wait a few minutes, because you know he's not trustworthy. He'll say whatever comes to his mind. It seems like that was a very off-the-cuff, spontaneous interview that he gave. And I don't think any lawyer is going to allow, although I don't know if they control him, that's the other issue, but no lawyer is going to allow Donald Trump to sit and just say whatever he wants to the special prosecutor, just that he's difficult to control, even by his lawyers. So is it significant? You know, it's as significant as this whole charade is. This is a bizarre theater of distraction that has been taking up the public space and the public discourse, while behind the scenes, all kinds of nonsense is going on. I mean, there are thousands of American troops now stationed permanently in Syria. There's arms going to fascists in Ukraine. There's tax policy that's going to have a short-term plus for the Republicans because of the short-term personal tax benefits, but got a long-term, absolutely destructive increase in wealth inequality. So all of this is going on while this hoopla about the special prosecutor is engaging all of our attention. So is it? I don't think Donald Trump is going to. He's going to have a, unless he breaks his, ignores his lawyers, which he probably will do. He'll have a controlled interview, and it's not going to come to very much. I mean, as you say, they're probably after him for money laundering, and that's where they're going to go with it.
Randy Credico, the situation now is that there's been four indictments. I mean, Michael Flynn pled guilty. Richard Gates has been indicted. Manafort indicted. Manafort, of course, for money laundering. Gates was his junior assistant. Papadopoulos, George Papadopoulos, who was, I don't know, in a drunken night, right, talked to the Australian ambassador about dirt on Hillary from Russia or something. Anyway, it's all slowed down in terms of indictments. There was such a big deal about the indictments. None of the indictments happened to be about Russia. What's your take on where we are at this stage in the investigation, Randy?
Well, you know, the
Russiagate is the big 800-pound rodeo clown in the room, because everyone is, as Jim has said, is being distracted by this. It's running on fumes. There's nothing there. They've had a year now. Nothing there at all when it comes to Russiagate and collusion. The only collusion that's going on is between the Democrats and Republicans. They're colluding to keep this thing alive, or keep Russia alive in the news, and not focus on this big giveaway tax bill, not focus on the NSA wiretapping bill that just was passed. That's the stuff that they don't want us to know about. They'd rather keep us distracted by this thing. And as I said, I think it's been about money laundering. I don't know with Sessions what that was all about, that conversation. That's the wild card here, because that, to me, leads back to Russiagate and not money laundering. But you never know. But I think they're spinning their wheels, but on purpose. Adam Schiff voted for this NSA bill, and so did all of the Northern Progressive Republic Democrats, like the two from Rhode Island and Amy Klobuchar, and the new savior from Alabama, Doug Jones. You know, those are the things I'm concerned about. The Russiagate thing is a complete distraction. I don't know where it's going.
Daniel Lazar, I can't help but to think that, at least in the near term, if we see new indictments, we're going to see indictments based on throwaway charges, as we've talked about previously on this show. Obstruction of justice, perjury, making a false statement, nothing that's going to really point to a major crime and put somebody away for many years, except for Manafort, which is an entirely different situation. It looks like, you know, serious money laundering, serious like international criminal activity going back a decade and a half. Do you see anything serious, at least in the near term, coming out of this this Mueller investigation, at least before he's finished with the president?
I do, actually. But I think what's really interesting is, I think that Russiagate has given way to Dossiergate. I'm really intrigued by this whole dossier angle, and what was used by, and how it was used to obtain a FISA warrant. And I think the Republicans, strangely enough, actually may be onto something in pressing this inquiry.
Yeah, the dossier. So let's talk about that, Jim Kavanaugh, if you could help the audience understand. So Christopher Steele, British intelligence agent, hired by first Republican rivals of Donald Trump, and then after he won the nomination, Christopher Steele and Fusion GPS, who hired him, were picked up by the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton. He went to Russia because that's where his sources were, and he undoubtedly paid Russians to get information that would be damaging to Donald Trump. It was unvetted information. In other words, not vetted through analysts to see whether it was true or not. He came back. He talks to the DNC. They have the salacious details about Donald Trump. True or not true, nobody knows. Probably a lot of it not true. And he also talks to the FBI, and the FBI then becomes interested in a possible Trump-Russia collusion. Are the Republicans now saying, is Steele now saying, that based on the hiring of a foreign intelligence agent from Britain who hired Russians or paid Russians, that then the FBI went to the FISA court and got a FISA warrant to be able to tap or listen to Donald Trump or the Trump campaign's communications? Is that what we're talking about?
Question. And the Democrats are trying to say, to push narratives that say it wasn't the Steele dossier that got the FBI interested in this and got these FISA warrants, because they know that's shaky ground. And, you know, the Steele dossier discredits itself. It says, the guy himself, I think, says a lot of this is not true. We know it's not true. It's been demonstrated that some of the facts asserted there are not true. I think it was Carter Page was supposed to be in Poland at some point. He wasn't, you know, and they were going to give 19% of the Russian oil industry to Carter Page or something. All of these ridiculous things. So there are a number of things that are known not to be true in it, and maybe some things that are true. But the fact is, it's a very shaky thing. The Democrats know it. And it's a very bad thing. I think Daniel's right. And there's a problem if that was the basis to get these FISA warrants. And that's what some Republicans want to go after and what the Democrats are afraid of. So they put out a number of other stories that, no, it wasn't this. It was a story about Carter Page's meeting with the guy in Malta or something. That's what got the FBI interested. And now it's gone on to this question of this Nunes memo. and what that means and what the underlying evidence of that is, which is something that would again indicate that there was a concerted effort to find reasons by the Obama administration to find reasons to spy and surveil the Trump campaign, and they ginned up the evidence to do that. Carter, the dossier member being one of them, and so it's a little bit of an issue. But I think again, there's a theater here. I don't think the Republicans are going to let this get that far either, and it's all a theater to distract attention from what's going on in terms of real policy underneath.
Randy Credico, we know that Michael Flynn, after Trump was elected, and while Flynn was heading up, in some measure, the transition team's foreign policy or national security policy, he had a conversation with perhaps Jared Kushner, who was in Mar-a-Lago in late December, when the UN Security Council was about to vote on a resolution condemning Israeli illegal settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. In an unusual step, President Obama had said the U.S. would abstain instead of vetoing any resolution that was hostile to Israel. We had Michael Flynn calling on December 22nd, Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador here in Washington, D.C., urging the Russians not to vote yes or to delay the vote in deference to the incoming Trump administration. And Trump had said, as we know, that he wanted to improve relations with Russia. So you had Kislyak being called by Flynn, who talked to Kushner really on behalf of Benjamin Netanyahu, who did not want this UN Security Council resolution to pass. The Russians, after a little bit of deliberation, called Michael Flynn back and said, no, they were going to go ahead and they were going to vote against Israel. So you had Michael Flynn intervening with the Russians, but not on behalf of Russia. It was on behalf of Israel. And the Russians said no. But Michael Flynn later, when interviewed about this discussion by the FBI 4 days after Trump took office and 4 days after Michael Flynn was the national security advisor, and when the FBI knew exactly what he had said to Kislyak, they were able to trip him up either by omission or commission. He didn't tell the whole truth, or maybe he lied about some part of the discussion, even though it wasn't illegal. Maybe that's just how Michael Flynn does it. Or maybe that's how FBI tricksters do it, when they can catch you up or get you. So here you have Michael Flynn then going down, and the FBI knew that they had Flynn going down because he had lied to the FBI. So you have a lying charge and thus, perjury before the FBI. Again, it's not really, instances or evidence of collusion with Russia. In that case, it's about Israel, and Russia said no. And yet I think the broad public doesn't really make any distinction, because how can they when they're just looking at these headlines? Flynn met with the Russians, blah, blah, blah. And that's what this is all about. But it's really nothing.
Well, I agree. Would you repeat that again? No, I'm kidding. I must say that I totally agree with that. What you just said, I mean, I can't really expand on that, because that's the whole crux of this investigation. I mean, in my case here, I was called by the Congressional Intel Committee, and I refused to testify. And if Mueller were to call me, I probably would refuse to testify, too, because that's all they get you on. John Kiriakou got it for that. Martha Stewart got it for that. And so they get these Mickey Mouse, they entrap you. That's what they do. They entrap you. They make it look like it's big. They've got nothing here, absolutely nothing solid when it comes to Russiagate. Russiagate is definitely a corpse that, they've got a tape somewhere inside simulating breathing here. But there's nothing to it. And that is a great example. And in Israel's involvement, a driving force behind a lot of what goes on today, as, for example, Trump meeting with Netanyahu and cutting off aid to Palestine. They're driving our foreign policy.
Yeah, they really are. Another thing that is really interesting to me is this new Republican tactic to just attack at every level the FBI as being some kind of rogue organization whose sole purpose is to take down the president of the United States. Last night on all the major news networks, Senator Ron Johnson, a sort of run-of-the-mill conservative Republican senator from Wisconsin, and not a nut, I think, by anybody's standards, breathlessly insisted that there was a secret society. He had a source who told him that there was a secret society working inside the FBI, and they had offsite meetings in which this cabal plotted to overthrow the Trump administration. Several of the journalists challenged him on this, first because it's just nutty, and second because this originated on InfoWars by Alex Jones, was picked up by Breitbart, and then ran around Republican circles. But they're running out and saying these ridiculous things with no proof, and they're talking about an organization that, come on, historically, you have to be a card-carrying Republican to even work for the FBI. But what they're trying to do is to pollute the jury pool, let's say, to plant these ridiculous stories in the press and hope that something comes of them, so that when more indictments come down, they can just dismiss it as being a conspiracy against the Trump administration.
Daniel Lazar, jump in.
Yeah, but I was going to say, this story is pretty wild. I agree, but there is plenty of grounds for suspicion about the way that the FBI and the intelligence agencies were behaving. They were mounting a concerted campaign to undermine Trump. I mean, look, I can't stand Trump as much as anybody, but nonetheless, though, they were mounting a concerted campaign to undermine the administration, and this dossier was apparently a big part of it. That dossier paid for, cooked up by the Democrats. So this is really strange stuff, really strange stuff. And so people with imagination is going wild, but there is some really weird behind-the-scenes machinations here.
That's what should be investigated, but not secret societies and secret handshakes and offsite meetings. And I mean, that's just it brings the level of debate, I think, down in the country.
Jim Cavanaugh, do you want to jump in on that? Go ahead if you do.
Well, it's, you know, there were these 5,000 emails. I mean, enormous number of emails from between FBI agents that were deleted. And you know, this is the problem. It's not. The term secret society is a bad term, but it's not outrageous, the idea that some faction or some group of people or some number of FBI agents or people who are close to the Obama administration, and not just agents, but people behind the scenes like Brennan and Clapper, who were kind of encouraging people to go out and find some evidence on Trump that could be used against him. That was kind of like a roguish operation within the intelligence community. So that's not outrageous. And that's the point I think that Daniel's getting at, and that the Republicans are trying to invoke, but are not going to pursue very far themselves, because they don't really want to go after the intelligence community either. So you've got on both sides this situation where there's something going on with Trump that's probably a lot of financial corruption, blah, blah, blah. And they're trying to blow that into something else. And there was something going on in the late stages of the Obama administration, which had to do with how can we cook up reasons for surveilling Trump and getting something on him, which probably would be financial corruption. And so the thin and incredible use of the dossier and of things like this and of conversations between FBI agents are things that are embarrassing and potentially have legal consequences too, but I don't think anybody really wants to go to the end with any of these things. I think they're content with getting their bases all riled up, each one over Russiagate, the Democrats, and over secret society collusion, with the Republicans, and they don't really want to get to the bottom of any of it, which would be serious. You know what I mean? It would be. We should find out about Donald Trump's financial corruption if there is some, and we should find out if John Brennan and the Obama administration intelligence instigated a campaign to try and get FISA to get warrants so that they could survey a political campaign that they didn't like. We should find out about that. But in the end, I don't think we're going to find out about any of that. This is going to go on with a bunch of fantastic headlines for the next year or so, and you're going to get indictments for lying to the FBI and indictments for financial corruption and indictments for, this and that, as you say, throwaway. But they're not going to go where they should go with the investigation.
Randy Credico, I know that you're not only a comedian and a political activist, you are a world-renowned historian, so I want to ask you a historical question.
Yeah, right. Go ahead.
Because you were there, let's talk about the history of actually the involvement, the actual involvement of, say, the FBI and intelligence agencies inside the political affairs of the United States, including high politics. It turns out that Washington Post, when they ran the story that helped bring down Richard Nixon, that led to his resignation rather than being impeached, the source of that, Deep Throat, in that case, was none other than Mark Felt, the number two at the FBI. So it wasn't like some crusading journalists who were simply pursuing every possible lead. The FBI, or Mark Felt, number two under J. Edgar Hoover, was spoon-feeding them information. There was also internecine struggles within the Nixon administration over how intelligence agencies, and particularly the FBI, would be centralized under a Nixon White House. There was the secret diplomacy of Nixon in the case of opening to China without, you know, any consultations on, except his own inner circle. There were a lot of things going on. But we also had the FBI deeply involved in the civil rights movement. They were bringing down and trying to bring down and trying to have Martin Luther King commit suicide. Certainly, FBI, coordinating with local police, were targeting the Nation of Islam when Malcolm X was a leader. And Malcolm X, when he split from the Nation of Islam, was assassinated in 1965. I mean, there's lots of potential intrusion by the FBI, in other words, meddling in our democracy. Anyway, go ahead, talk about it from the big picture point of view, if you would.
Well, you left out Fred Hampton. You know, that was coordinated with the Chicago police, and there's hundreds of instances of the FBI meddling in the affairs of this democracy, and the CIA and the NSA. They all meddle in this so-called democracy. And the FBI, you go back, you're right, this guy Felt, he was the guy that they went to. Well, what happened? You got Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford comes in. You still have Kissinger. You bring in Cheney and Rumsfeld. So everything was the same. Is you just got rid of this distraction, Richard Nixon, and, you know, things went on seamlessly, our foreign policy. You know, FBI has done this since the very beginning, going way back when they were just the Bureau of Investigation, you know, in the early days when Hoover was appointed by, 1919. They've been meddling. They've been, falsifying documents and information. So it's a rogue domestic outfit, and I'm sure that's what's going on here. And plus, you Clapper and Hayden, these guys are always on television pushing this. I don't know what they ultimately want, but so far they're getting what they want, which is we're in Syria, we're expanding our involvement towards Russia, in Estonia and Poland, in Israel. So, I mean, right now Trump is doing what they want. And so they're getting their way.
I mean, it's all a means of putting a kind of a leash on Trump that they're afraid of his impetuousness and the things he was saying during the campaign, which he has no political capacity to follow through on. But these are, you know, ways of keeping a kind of public leash on him. And it's been working. I mean, and, you know, nobody should have believed what he said anyway. I mean, he was going to be easily pushed around by generals. And that's what's been happening.
Yeah. That's what's been happening. In fact, he didn't take General Kelly, his chief of staff, to Davos with him. And that's actually newsworthy. In any other administration, it wouldn't be newsworthy. And it's because he does surround himself with generals.
And they all look like Brando from Apocalypse Now.
They do.
The Kurtz character.
Colonel Kurtz.
That's it. Every one of them's got a shaved head and they're scary.
The horror.
We talked about Mark Felt, number two at the FBI. He was Deep Throat. He was the one talking to Bernstein and Woodward in the Washington Post. And that's what led to the Watergate bring down of Richard Nixon. The number three at the FBI at that time was William Sullivan. I don't know if you remember him, but William Sullivan came out and denounced J. Edgar Hoover around the same time and said the FBI was the real power in Washington. And he said that they had collected dirt on all the politicians. Hoover did, that Hoover was the real power in Washington. You guys probably don't remember, but William Sullivan went hunting in 1977 and was shot to death in a hunting accident, right, in the midst of his continued sort of exposés of J. Edgar Hoover. Nonetheless, not trying to suggest anything, but we have a long long storied history where the so-called mythology about American democracy being this pure representation by the people who get a chance to vote for their leaders, and their leaders come to Washington and their leaders represent them. I mean, that's a naive understanding of the way American politics and Washington politics work. And we see this playing out right now. And of course, we have a toxic combination. We have the Democrats are fighting for the Republicans for narrow advantage. The Republicans are fighting the Democrats for narrow advantage. Both parties are wedded to the military-industrial complex, so they're pursuing a policy of hostility towards Russia. Donald Trump said he wanted to improve relations with Russia. He no longer is talking like that at all. Instead, as one of our other guests said, they're sending lethal weapons to fascists in the Ukraine. In Ukraine, that can only be perceived as hostility towards Russia. And I just really want to ask, let's go back to Daniel Lazar. Daniel, if you're looking at down the road, we have the 2018 elections coming up. The Democrats, it seems to me, although Trump has pursued such a reactionary policy on immigration, on racism, on the rolling back of any police reforms to stop the epidemic of police violence directed against black and brown communities here, the exiting of the Paris Climate Treaty, hostility towards Iran. I mean, the Democrats only focus still on Russia. I don't think that's going to resonate with the people. We have 1 minute left. Go ahead.
I agree. I don't think so at all. But I think by 2018, the so-called scandal will have petered out pretty well. I think that really one thing that's important about Russiagate is the way it's being used to bludgeon the American people into sort of believing this flood of propaganda, and the truth has been lost sight of. People have no idea which way is up anymore. They're so used to this propaganda coming out of Washington from both parties that they're totally disoriented. I think that democracy is fading rapidly, and I don't know where it's going to end up.
Randy Credico, as I discussed with you and noted, you're a historian. Thinking back about how some of the earlier political leaders from the bygone era, Richard Nixon or Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton, what would they make of all of this?
Yes. My fellow Americans, let me just make this perfectly clear. You left out a very important mysterious death, and that is Martha Mitchell, who was talking a lot, and suddenly I think she committed suicide back then. But this is the same thing that happened to me. You got to be careful with FBI, the deep state. They were in complete control of my administration. And of course, Reagan, as you know, used the same kind of propaganda. The Sandinistas have done it again. They've invaded Honduras, and I have a photograph that bears me out. Well, it's not really a photograph. It's a shadowgraph. And then, of course, Bill Clinton, as we know what he did, starved 500,000 people to death in Iraq. No one ever talks about what he did back then. He executed this guy who was missing a brain. He left the Rwanda. The genocide happened there. Bombed Serbia. There was a lot of things that he did back then. Welfare, as we know it, ended that. And everyone thinks he's a great guy, and his wife. Well, his wife knew all about it, so that's as far as I'm going to go with it.
All right, and just for our audience, Martha Mitchell, of course, was the wife of John Mitchell, who was Richard Nixon's attorney general. That's all the time we have. We've been joined from New York City by three guests. Daniel Lazar, journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Jim Kavanaugh is the editor of thepolemicist.net, and Randy Credico is an activist, a comedian. I called him a historian, so he's now a historian. And he's the former director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we begin a new weekly segment that we call Criminal Injustice. We'll look at some of the most egregious conducts of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is so routinely denied to so many Americans. In today's segment, judges in the state of Oklahoma are sending people arrested on minor drug offenses to a program called CARE, which stands for Christian Alcoholics and Addicts in Recovery. But in reality, they're sent to work in dangerous chicken processing plants, where they work all day for free processing chickens for KFC, Popeyes, and Walmart, among other places. And if they complain, they're threatened with being sent to prison. We'll talk about that and other issues. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. Paul is also the editor of Prison Legal News magazine. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us on the show, John.
Thank you.
I have to tell you, Paul, I read this article about this chicken processing plant in Oklahoma yesterday. It was just published in Prison Legal News magazine, and I was outraged. I just can't see how this is not slave labor, how this is not illegal, and why the Justice Department is not coming down like a ton of bricks on some of these state judges in the state of Oklahoma. What do you think?
Well, I think that one of the things is that, unfortunately, slavery is all too common in the United States, and the exploitation of prison slave labor in various guises is pretty normalized and has been normalized, unfortunately, in this country for a long time. So when we found out about how prisoners were being exploited, it's just kind of like just the latest in a long saga of prison slave labor exploitation. You know, we've reported in the past about how prisoners have been used in everything from work release to Walmart's used them to, there's just been, prisoners have been exploited, I think, for their labor in pretty much any way under the sun. And part of the problem, of course, is that the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution never outlawed slavery. All it did was limit it to people that have been convicted of an offense, of a crime.
That's right.
And which has led, one, at least one court's commented that prisoners are slaves of the state. Is that private chattel slavery may have been outlawed or banned, but back in the real world, this has meant that the government is free to enslave prisoners, and the government enslaving prisoners also means that they can basically farm them out or rent them out to private businesses and private companies. And that happens quite a bit too.
Yeah, this also happens in the federal system with something called Unicor. So many federal prisons have these Unicor facilities attached to them, where they're involved in different kinds of, well, usually it's manufacturing, but it can be, you know, call centers or any number of things, where prisoners are forced to work full 8-hour days in these factories. They manufacture things like, well, when I was at the Federal Correctional Institution at Loretto, Pennsylvania, they made high-speed fiber optic cable for the Navy. They got paid, 25 cents an hour, 40 cents an hour. The cable was of terrible quality because there was certainly no pride in workmanship when you're making a quarter an hour and being forced to work. And at the same time, these Unicor facilities drive legitimate business people out of business because they can't compete when the prison system is using slave labor.
Yeah, and I think that's also one of the things, too, that's often overlooked is the negative impact that prison slavery has on the wages of free workers and everything from, causing free workers to do everything from lose their jobs to depressing wages or pushing wages down. And, these are pretty serious problems. They're well documented. And but the other bigger reflection, too, is, and I think that the Oklahoma story, what that draws on, is the fact that basically by using prison slave labor to do the work in these chicken processing plants, part of the reality is it's very difficult to get people to want to do this dangerous, hard and degrading work. And one alternative is they raise wages, and if you pay people enough money, you'll get someone to do it. But they don't want to do that. They want to maximize their profits. So then the cheap solution is they get prisoners to do it and literally force them to do this dirty, dangerous work for little pay. And literally, they're doing it at gunpoint under threat of further incarceration or being, further exploited and further abused. So that's kind of the essence, I think, of prison slavery in this country is, forcing people to do the work that they can't get non-prisoners to do for, a decent wage.
Yeah. Kevin Gustala, you follow these issues all over the country at shadowproof.com. This can't be specific just to Oklahoma. What else is happening out there?
Well, I think what's remarkable about this case here in Oklahoma is that it speaks to a way of adapting to a trend, I think, because there's been a fair amount of activism in the last few years to end mass incarceration. And so you see this very savvy move by businesses to develop quote unquote alternatives to incarceration. However, in this case, what we can see is it's almost as bad, if not worse, than just being in a prison cell because you're required to do very hard physical labor. And in some cases, you may not even be physically capable of doing that labor. So, you see, I think there's one example in this class action lawsuit of a guy who has a club foot. He has a club foot and he decides he's just not going to continue on with this and he'd rather take a fine or whatever consequences for not completing the treatment program. And I think you also see that under the guise of getting some kind of rehabilitation, or it kind of seems like they're taking this concept that is popularized of restorative justice and perverting it in the sense of, well, if you want treatment for your addiction, we agree that you should be rehabbed. But go here and do this work for us, and that's how you're going to become whole again.
Yeah, that's really the issue, is this is just a big lie. There is no rehabilitation, whether it's Christian or otherwise. The prison system, whether it's at the federal level nationally or at the state level individually, nobody spends money on education, on training, on rehabilitation. And then just to make matters worse, they've transitioned into this system of slave labor where they force you to work either for nothing or for pennies in facilities that do not meet OSHA requirements. Paul, I think you mentioned in this article about Oklahoma that even in the event that you, let's say, lose a finger while you're processing these chickens, they just wrap it up and tell you to go back onto the line and get back to work.
Exactly. I think one of the things that's important to note about one of the advantages that's used to basically to push or tout slave labor for these companies is telling them that, you can exploit prison slave labor. And by the way, the prisoners have no insurance. They have no health insurance. You're not paying for workman's comp. So if the prisoners get injured, basically any health care expenses are going to be picked up by the taxpayer. And so the company is basically free to exploit the prisoners into doing physically dangerous work without fear of the consequences. If the prisoners wind up getting injured, if they wind up getting killed, even the company isn't on the hook as they would be for workman's comp or any other type of insurance plan. And It creates a really perverse incentive to not even pretend to care about providing for safe work conditions or anything like that.
The big problem, well, there's many big problems. One big problem is that the prisoners don't have a voice. The First Amendment doesn't apply to them, with the exception of organizations like Prison Legal News or Shadow Proof. There's not a message that they can get out. They need somebody else to be their advocate. And if you protest, you're subjected to harsh discipline. And frequently throughout American history, when the prisoners really wanted to protest about inhumane conditions, it ultimately led to a rebellion because have rights. You can't have a peaceful legal demonstration, get a permit from the warden, and then march around the prison with banners and placards. And so there's a sort of inherent repression, violence cycle that's built into the system. And we're talking about a lot of people in America. There's 2.3 million people at least who are incarcerated, millions more who are in the system on probation or parole. I'm looking at the prison strike that's going on in Florida.
Florida, yes.
Let's talk about that, Paul. What's going on with that?
Well, basically, so for Martin Luther King Day, there was a planned protest and strike by a number of prisoners. We still haven't gotten a lot of information about how it actually panned out, or you know, or what happened with it. But I think that this is kind of like just the basic response of, you know, of prisoners protesting both their enslavement, and Florida is one of the states where prisoners literally get paid nothing for their work, not even a token amount or gratuity, as they call it. You know, they're literally paid nothing. And so that's on the one hand. And then on the other hand, they're literally dropping like flies due to inadequate medical care. We've seen the phenomenon of each year out of a prison system with 100,000 prisoners, 400 to 500 prisoners a year are dying of medical neglect. And typically, I mean, by medical neglect, they're dying of, you know, simple, easy to treat illnesses that, generally speaking, don't kill people in first world or industrialized countries, unless, of course, you're in Florida.
Right. Kevin Gastala, you've been covering a story, too, that's just a recent story that's been very upsetting. You talk about an immigrant, you and your colleague, Brian Sonnenstein. I should add Brian's name. He's doing great work at Shadowproof. An immigrant woman who attempted suicide in a detention center after trying to avoid the guard who had been sexually abusing her. We saw a similar case in Texas just a couple of months ago. Can you tell us a little bit about this case?
Yeah, this is, as you were talking, she's from El Salvador, and she was here, and there's a woman, apparently a guard, who is well known to the detainees, who uses her authority or power to, basically domineer over these individuals and have her way with anyone. And so this woman, Laura Monterosa, challenged her in the sense that she actually started talking about this conduct that's going on behind bars. And in effect, what happened is, instead of being taken seriously, she's facing the threat of she's facing retaliation and further threats possibly to her well-being. And she says, I mean, I'm going to quote her here. She says, I'm afraid I'm going to run into the guard. I have run into her in the dining and in recreation. That's why I have not gone there. So she's talking about how she's not going to get her meals anymore during the day because she's afraid she's going to run into the person who is abusing her. And essentially she gets threatened with punishment because she's missing her meals in the prison.
Right. That's actually a punishable offense, skipping meals in prison.
I want to go back, if we could, to the prison strike, Paul. I mean, you writing from Prison Legal News, what's happening to the strike? I mean, I was aware of the Texas prisoners, say, in the 1980s, and Texas was notorious for its chain gangs and all kinds of terrible treatment of prisoners that had been institutionalized for many decades, maybe for more than 100 years. The prisoners filed a class action lawsuit. They carried out prison strikes. What happens, though, when prisoners strike? I mean, are they just locked down? Are they put into solitary confinement? What happens next?
And typically what happens is, yes, prisoners are locked down, and often they're placed, they're locked down, and the ringleaders or the organizers, if they're identified, wind up being placed in placed in solitary confinement or isolation. And what I have to say is, you know, I mean, I've organized prison strikes and prison boycotts and things like that. And the key thing is, I think that kind of what makes for more successful prison strikes is, for one thing, like, you know, Florida prisoners have organized strikes, but they're organizing them on weekends and holidays, which isn't very effective. But I think that the bigger thing, though, is that, when you have the big participation, it really puts a crimp in business as usual in prisons and jails, because at the end of the day, American prisons run on prison slavery. They depend on and rely on exploiting the labor of prisoners in the facilities at every level, both using them as cooks to laundry workers, to janitors, to manufacturing items in their slave factories and whatever. And so the bigger the participation, then, you know, the more the more it disrupts their whole slave operations. Part of the problem, though, is this is the problem that I think we've had that has confronted, on the one hand, has confronted every system that uses slave labor, including the American system of chattel slavery, to Nazi concentration camps, to, again, all forms of social slavery. At the end of the day, the workers aren't very motivated. There's always the ongoing threat of rebellion or the slaves just for whatever reason not working. And so basically, and this has all historically been met with vicious repression and brutalization to keep the slaves working. And basically, that's something that has never really changed under any system of slavery, whether it's the U.S. government doing in its prisons, whether it was chattel slavery in the American South, or slave labor in Nazi concentration camps or whatever. It always comes down to, at the end of the day, people are being forced to work under threat of punishment. And how brutal and violent it gets is just, you know, it's just pretty much a question of the day. Yeah, it wasn't that long ago that here in that in the state of Alabama and the state of Florida were using prisoner chain gangs to have prisoners, you know, doing menial tasks of picking up garbage and cutting the grass alongside interstates. And any of the prisoners that refused to do that were chained to rails in the hot sun, deprived of food, deprived of water. They weren't allowed to use the bathroom, so they had to urinate or defecate on themselves. And, you know, this was happening on our nation's highways within the last 20 years. This is the brutal face of American slavery. This is how the slaves are treated when they rebel. And I think this is all a logical consequence of slavery. Whenever you're forcing people to work against their will and not paying them anything, the only way you ensure their continued obedience and enslavement is by brutalizing them. And that's something that the American prison system does extremely well.
John Kiriakou, I think it's important for our audience and people in the United States to realize what Paul is talking about. This is a system of slavery.
It is.
And it's not a small number of people. Again, it's a couple million people. When you look at the 13th Amendment, the way it's crafted, it was adopted, you know, inaugurated in January 1865, became the law of the land in December 65, at the end of the Civil War, outlawing chattel slavery. But the actual language of the 13th Amendment, which is considered by far one of the most progressive pieces in the U.S. Constitution, but when you actually read the words, this is what it says. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for crime whereof of the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. So just as Paul started off this conversation, reading the 13th Amendment, which is considered sort of a freedom amendment, the end of the enslavement of African peoples in the United States, you have a system whereby the prisons, which are disproportionately made up of black prisoners, and disproportionately, almost exclusively made up of working class and poor people, people are legally entitled to be enslaved. I think most Americans actually don't know that and don't have their head wrapped around it.
I think most Americans don't know that. One of the things, too, that bothers me is even after all these years and all these reports of abuse in the prison system, there are so few elected officials who are willing to go out there publicly and do something about it. And Kevin Gastala mentions in this article that the only reason this poor woman, Laura Monterosa, was released from solitary confinement was because of the intervention of Congressman Lloyd Doggett, a Democrat of Texas. I can tell you that when I started writing my Letters from Loretto blog series when I was in prison, a blog series that Kevin Gastala published, I was threatened with solitary confinement, and it was Lloyd Doggett who came to my defense. And that was the only reason that I didn't go to solitary. But Lloyd Doggett is this lonely voice in the wilderness. I can't speak to the state level, of course, but at the federal level, nobody wants to talk about these problems. Kevin, would you agree with that?
Yeah, and I think that there's a tremendous risk that you're taking when you decide to write about what's going on within the walls of the prison where you're incarcerated. And actually, I'd like to just quickly call attention to what's happening to somebody involved in the prison strike in Florida. My colleague Brian just published a report, and it's under the headline, Florida Officials Deny Operation Push is Ongoing, Even as They Retaliate Against Prisoners. And he obtained a letter from an activist named Kevin Rashid Johnson, who first off wrote articles about the upcoming prison strike and the and on other articles about the prison, I presume. And then he was disciplined. And then he says in his quote, emergency note, that he is being, this is a quote, he's being literally tortured in retaliation for article on prison strike and conditions by the warden. And he goes on to say that he has no heat, cell like outside, the temperature in the 30s, toilet doesn't work, the window to outside doesn't close, and cold air blowing in the cell. It's daytime and so cold, can barely write. And yeah, there are people who have been following his case that are actually worried about his life. And if you don't have congressional intervention to help someone like Kevin or even yourself, you are in dire situation.
Absolutely right. And I can tell you that the conditions that he is describing are actually not uncommon in American prisons. I was in a housing unit that had no windows. And we had a prison strike while I was there. We were locked down, couldn't even leave the unit for meals. The meals were brought to us, and the meals were a bologna sandwich and an apple that you ate, you know, three times a day, a bologna sandwich and an apple. And it was cold. It was the winter. And the first thing that the cops do is they shut the heat off. And they're in these glass bubbles where they have space heaters. And so they're nice and comfortable and internet access. And they sit there and watch Netflix. And the rest of us are freezing. And there's nothing you can do. That's just prison life.
Yeah. I want to go back to how people, and this is one of the reasons, John, we wanted to do this segment on a weekly basis. This is a big chunk of American society, 2.3 million people in prison. That means all of their families are connected. And many, many times the prisoners are not only, you know, of course, deprived of a voice and a vote. They're deprived of their basic First Amendment rights. Those are taken away. They're also put in prisons that are far away from their families, and it's hard for their families, especially for working class folks, to even get to the prison.
Absolutely right.
To see them. So the prisoners feel additionally isolated. The whole system is set up in a way to just, you know, criminalize the inmate population additionally, or punish them additionally in top of the time they have to serve. I'm looking at Shadowproof. Website, and we want to encourage our listeners to go to Shadowproof and also Prison Legal News.
Yes, we do.
Here's one story. Massachusetts County plans to make video screens the only way for incarcerated to see loved ones.
Right.
So you have prisons that are far away from where people live. They have to pay for bus transportation or get there somehow. And now we're going to have a situation where the prisoners can't even see their loved ones except through on video screens?
And those video visits is what they call them. They're extraordinarily expensive in some cases. And Paul, correct me if I'm wrong. In some cases, there's something like $1 a minute.
Or more expensive. And basically, I think it's really clear to understand what's going on here is that basically they're taking formerly free government services like visitation and then replacing it with a monetized monopoly alternative so that basically a hedge fund owned company that's giving a kickback to the facility, they get the government to eliminate the, they've gotten the government to eliminate the free alternative of free visitation, then replace it with this monetized, extremely expensive alternative. And the other thing too is, you know, I think we need to get away from calling it video visitation and call it what it is, which is video calling, because, you know, talking to someone on a video screen in prison or jail doesn't mean you visited them in prison any more than if I talk to someone on Skype in India, that doesn't mean I visit. I mean, I'm still sitting in my office in Florida.
That's right. It's not a visit.
Yeah. Kevin, what can the average person do? Obviously, we have an epidemic of people being incarcerated. There's over-policing. There's disproportionately long sentences. Once in prison, people are isolated, they're demonized, they're targeted, they're punished if they try to speak out, their families have a hard time seeing them. I mean, this is a national crisis. This is something that both you and Paul are focused on. What are you suggesting for the average person or people around the country who believe in justice? What can we do?
I don't actually think it's as hopeless as you put it. I do believe that the people who run these prisons, they know that there's a real threat if people are organizing and engaged in consistent activism against the way people are being treated within the walls of these facilities. And that's why, you know, if you take the big prison strike around, which is Operation Push in Florida right now, the Florida Department of Corrections is going above and beyond to act like there's nothing happening within these facilities. Meanwhile, you do have isolated reports getting out to people who are organizers where they can tell people the truth of what's happening. And there are, you know, confirmed reports that possibly 16 facilities still have things going on like work stoppage. And so, you know, in that case, people aren't abandoning these people. They're actually helping them challenge their confinement conditions. And if they don't feel like they've been, you know, completely forgotten by the outside world, then they're empowered to continue to challenge their condition.
You know, I want to say one other thing, too, and I apologize to everybody for jumping from one subject to another. But Paul Wright sent me something that is just so outrageous. I want him to talk about it in this last 60 seconds that we have. Paul, you sent to me an article in which you are quoted, and the article is about the movie Dunkirk. The producers of this film, which is nominated for multiple Academy Awards, used prison labor, forced prison labor, to construct the set. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so I was contacted by the reporter for the publication, I think it's Payday Report, and I wasn't aware of it until they contacted me that that apparently, and for those who haven't seen or don't know about it, Dunkirk is apparently the biggest grossing movie about World War II in history, and it's come out, and it's up for a bunch of Oscars, and one of the Oscars that it's up for is for best set design. And then it turns out that in the promo book that was written to accompany the movie, a sharp-eyed reporter noted that they're actually bragging about the fact that they used prison slave labor to construct a lot of the sets and to basically cut down costs, which is, I think, the other way of saying boosting the profits for the movie studio and the investors that made it. So, and you know, and one of the things I say in the article I'm quoted about is that, you know, I think that hopefully that the use of prison slave labor should hopefully disqualify them from an Oscar, because I think we, you know, we've seen this thing in Hollywood where actors and producers and such like Harvey Weinstein, James Franco and Kevin Spacey, basically they've been, I think, you know, rightly shamed for sexual harassment or sexual assaults that they are at least accused of carrying out. And yet here we have a company that's a movie studio and producers and everyone else who openly admit to and are bragging about the use of prison slaves.
Yeah, we're getting close to being out of time, but John, I agree with Paul Wright. That should be in the... Well, not in the credits, the absence of credits, but they should be shamed. They should be called out. I mean, that's an important fact. And of course, unless we do it, unless the people do it, it won't happen, but it needs to happen.
That's it. We are out of time, unfortunately. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gustala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. He is the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. And he also is the editor of Prison Legal News Magazine, PLN. Please stay with us. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.